Hello again, grandkids. It's the second part of our ECW nostalgia trip down memory lane. It's Eric, Dusty, and Dan one more time. Dusty, how are you tonight?
Yo!
And Dan, how are you doing tonight, my man?
I'm doing very well, and I don't have a good catchphrase to quote the Sandman or anyone like that, so I'll just say that I'm doing well.
Cool. You could have just pointed in the air, and
that's right. That's right. that would have been good. We've seen how long it would have taken anyone to figure out the that reference.
Well, I don't know if tonight's kind of a supplement to last night, or if last night's a supplement to tonight, or exactly how we want to consider this. But this special edition of the Stunt Granny Audio is going to focus on kind of the chronology of ECW. Dating back to even its predecessor, Tri-State Wrestling Association. Probably not going to spend a lot of time on that, but, you know, work our way through the wrestlers who came and went and into the pay-per-view era, into the TNN era, and then its ultimate demise. Yeah, so I'm ready if you guys are.
Sounds great.
Cool. Of course, like I said, the predecessor to ECW was the Tri-State Wrestling Association, owned and operated by Joel Goodhart, with the financial backing of one jewelry store owner known as Todd Gordon. And I have pretty decent recollections of reading about Tri-State Wrestling Association in the After magazines, and seeing, like, bar wars, you know, this weird company up in Philadelphia having wrestling shows at bars. And they were blood and guts and gore and all this stuff. And it kind of caught my attention in that way. I was going to see if you guys had any other thoughts or memories of this long-forgotten Tri-State Wrestling Association.
I remember seeing pictures in the After mags of the Bar Wars, you know, and just thinking it's so different from what WWF is showing us, you know?
Yep.
And, you know, just, I don't know, just being semi-intrigued about it without really knowing anything about it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to give them just a little bit of credit, too, I mean, for some reason, the Bar Wars thing is what sticks out to me, but I'm actually a ProWrestlingHistory.com, which I love to go to, especially when doing these type of audios. And the first card that's listed for Tri-State Wrestling Association was from April 16th of 1989 in Newark, Delaware, and it apparently drew 1,100 people. And according to the results here, it was a three-match card. I don't know if something was left out or not. But Tom Brandy...
I have to guarantee you that they just left some stuff out that they didn't remember.
I would think so, yeah. The three matches that are listed are Tom Brandy, who we know better as Salvatore Sincere and Johnny Gunn, and I can't remember what else he was, the Patriot lately, beating whoever the WWA champion was at the time, Joe Daniels, by disqualification. Bam Bam Bigelow wrestling the Mystery Man to a double disqualification. And then Don Morocco wrestling Dr. D. David Schultz to a double disqualification.
Difficult to get finishes on the Tri-State Wrestling show.
Apparently.
Like that.
Especially when you have to protect your talent like the Mystery Man.
Yeah.
But I believe they ran, what is it, Pennsylvania Hall fairly often, or is that the name of the building? I mean, a pretty decent-sized building in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
They had
super
shows from time to time that I think, you know, drew well but lost money because they stacked the cards with talent, as from what I've heard and what I recall.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the venue that's listed on here multiple times is called McGonagall Hall. And, yeah, the average
gate.
Yeah,
that's Temple University, I think. Is it not?
I'm not sure. That would make sense because it holds at least 1,400 people, because that seems to be, well, here, McGonagall Hall drawing 2,000. You know, 1,500s. They're drawing a lot of people. But, yeah, just looking at some of these cards, the names that were being brought in, Bam Bam Bigelow, Terry Gordy, the Junkyard Dog, Paul Jones, Nikita Koloff, Larry Zbysko, Manny Fernandez, David Sammartino. So apparently Larry Zbysko is taking a four-foot bump that night off a press slam. Harry Von Erich versus Jerry Lawler for the USWA title, you know. And, yeah,
oh.
So I can see where... Yeah, the money would be flying out the window. Oh, here's a guy named Cheetah Kid was on one of these early shows. And your standard Rockin' Rebel and King Kahlua and, God, who else is on here? Yeah, your J.T. Smiths and D.C. Drakes and everybody else like that.
And again, I should have done more research on this, but if I recall correctly, they had a lot of kind of fan question and answer type sessions or luncheons with the wrestlers that he would run, that Joel Goodhart would run. And I want to say he had a radio show too.
Yes, that's not familiar. Okay.
Yes, he did.
Cool. So, I mean, at least he had a means of promoting his cards, which shows in the draw that he had.
Yeah, he's getting good attendance throughout here.
Yep. Another cool thing that I noticed, too, though, and I remember this from the After Mags also, but Dan, like I think you said, they were putting on bigger cards. They were putting on quarterly cards like the, what are the names here, the Super Summer Sizzler and the Autumn Armageddon. And a few years down the road, it would be shows like that where Eddie Gilbert, I think, was starting to take over the book, and he was having his feud with Cactus Jack, and there's one particular show where Gilbert and Cactus Jack had a series of three different gimmick matches. I remember that got big coverage in the magazines.
Yep.
Like anything else that you guys...
Buddy Rogers was going to wrestle for them before he died. He was going to come out of retirement and wrestle Buddy Landell, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
Very good.
That was covered in the After Mags pretty big. So I assume that's all... I don't know why that would be a lie, but I remember reading about that. And then and he kept himself in shape, and he was going to come back for Tri-State, I believe.
Yeah, in fact... January 25th, 1992 in Pennsylvania, or Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, canceled. The scheduled matches for this show included Buddy Rogers versus Buddy Landell, Steve Williams and Terry Gordy versus Dan Crawford and Doug Furniss, Eddie Gilbert versus Kevin Sullivan, Falls Count Anywhere, and Chris Benoit versus Shiro Koshinaka. And this was January of 92.
Wow. Yeah, that's not a cheap card to put on, even.
Yeah, it's like the entire plane from Tokyo to Philadelphia, full of pro wrestlers.
Yeah.
So, let's see, it was around this time, late 92, I think, early 93, when Eddie Gilbert got the book. And I know both of you guys can probably talk about Eddie Gilbert as a booker. I don't know, I'll flip a coin. Dusty, what do you remember about Eddie Gilbert, especially kind of leading up to this time frame?
Well, I just saw what he did in Smoky Mountain. He made that one appearance.
Mm-hmm.
Always a very good talker, but he was, like, legitimately insane, you know, especially near the end there. And I mean, even with the Lawler stuff, because I watched Lawler's shoot interview, mm-hmm. and he's like, I never had a problem with the guy. But he keeps bad-mouthing me behind my back, you know. It's just like... The whole thing was in his head, you know? So Eddie was kind of a weird guy, but also very smart. I mean, he was on the booking team in the NWA in the late 80s with Cornette and Jim Ross when they were booking excellent shows. So, I mean, he's certainly capable.
Mm-hmm. Dan, what a...
Well, Eddie Gilbert, if I'm not mistaken, was kind of Bill Watts' booker, you know, at the end of UWF.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the best written television. Now Bill Watts had the final say, and it was good for Eddie to have a editor, for lack of a better word. But, I mean, there's no question he could book.
Eddie won the Wrestling Observer's Booker of the Year in 1988. That was his last year in his tenure at UWF.
That was probably that would have been when he was in Continental. Because by 1988, UWF would have been no more.
That's true. They would have been bought. Okay, so yeah.
And he was booking Continental, and he booked that very well, too. And he worked with Paul Lee down there, and he had...
Yeah, his understudy, was Paul Heyman.
Yeah, I mean, he, you know, that was great stuff. And, you know, there's a lot of good Torch talks for those VIP members of the Torch that want to go back and find them with Eddie and talking about how he booked Continental and how he had it set up the exact same way that he had Mid-South set up. He had the announcer in a tux, and he really had it up and running, but that was not a very populous part of the country, and it didn't, it couldn't really sustain the type of talent I think that he wanted to have. But yeah, I think that people would say Eddie had outside-the-ring issues there by the end, and he wasn't as stable as he once was. I think some of the things he might have said about Jerry Lawler were just to kind of keep his name out there sometimes, because he went back to Memphis and worked quite a bit, and he always seemed to have a place to work there with Lawler. It's not like, you know, he wouldn't go there and work from time to time and and do pretty well. So I wouldn't, I mean, I don't know. I haven't watched a number of shoot interviews that Dusty has, so maybe I'm missing something, but I wouldn't put too much into this. You know, I don't think Jerry Lawler at this point would badmouth him at all, obviously.
Well,
they did a lot together. You shouldn't really badmouth those that have passed, I suppose. But the only other thing I'd say about the Tri-State era that kind of stood out to me just from the After magazines was the Blackhearts. And how their masks were that covered every part of their face, and I always thought, oh, that's kind of, and they, you know, they looked the part. I don't even, you know, Luna Vachon managed them, and I don't even know who they were. If they, I don't think they made it very big after that, but they might have been the Super Destroyers that had the early ECW Tag Team Champions, as far as I know. I really don't know who they were, but
I do know that I have a videotape, or it's probably a DVD or one or the other, with the Blackhearts wrestling on it with Luna as their
their
manager.
Yeah, I have that too. It was an Eddie Gilbert Cactus Jack card, and I somehow got a hold of that. And
well, wasn't one of them Gangrel?
See, I want to say that might be true. I don't know.
That would make a lot of sense.
David Heath.
We did show prep for this, but we didn't. I didn't think about talking about the Blackhearts until just now. So
I don't think most people thought
really
about
good
it.
Look.
No, it was cool. They were cool outfits. I don't know who came up with that.
Yeah,
David was one of them.
Okay, that makes sense.
And I don't know, just to mention a couple other things to play off of what you just said, Dan, before we get into the aforementioned insanity of Eddie Gilbert costing him his job. You talked about the less populous part of the country where Eddie Gilbert was the booker. Then he gets a chance to go up to ECW and to Philadelphia. Let's kind of talk about Philadelphia for a second, because this was one of the rare towns that was a place where both WWF and the NWA or Jim Crockett Promotions could go and sell out. You know, one sells out the Spectrum and one sells out the Civic Center. I'm trying to think, and I know they talked about that in a DVD.
They talked about the rise and fall of ECW DVD.
Okay, yeah. So let's talk a little bit about Philadelphia, because they've always been kind of the off-kilter, we want blood sort of crowd.
Okay, yeah. I mean, definitely it was a passionate wrestling town that had fans that probably did want a more adult-themed product, and so it was a perfect fit for ECW and rising up from Tri-State. And you know, the discussion was brought up about Eddie Gilbert's booking, and for one, I agree with Dusty, the stuff he did in Smoky Mountain, I remember watching it and thinking he didn't seem quite right. And then, you know, he died not too long after that, and I was always a big fan of his, and so I didn't really, you know, I didn't like to see that at the time, and certainly, you know, hated that he died too young. But kind of the idea, Eddie Gilbert grew up on Memphis wrestling, which was a lot of run-ins and a lot of action, but sometimes things kind of stayed in place in Memphis. There wasn't a lot of storyline development and things like this. And I'm looking at this from interviews Paul Heyman's done and things he's said, and I think he's right. I think Paul eventually getting the book led to more progression in the in the style. And I think his exact quote was, you know, there's only so long Philadelphia fans want to see the Moondogs run out and hit people with trash cans. And I think that it was probably necessary that, and I'm not saying Eddie couldn't have booked, even to some degree, helped book a national promotion, but I don't think he'd booked a lot longer than Paul. He'd done a lot more. And I don't know that he had the type of, you know, just nonstop number of ideas that Paul had to make things really interesting. And I'm sure we'll talk about some of those angles.
Sure. Yeah. And Paul was definitely, I mean, Eddie Gilbert was well-traveled too, but Paul, I think he was starting to get some miles under his belt. And he was younger, and he was, I think, I don't know, was he younger? Yeah, I think he was a few years younger, and
Oh, then Eddie, no question, yeah. No, because he started when he was, Very young, yeah.
Yeah.
I think at that point he had more drive than Eddie. He was pissed at WCW and he wanted to shove it down their throat.
Yeah. And it's probably more of a motivator to be pissed with WCW than it is to be pissed at Jerry Lawler.
Yeah, that's
true.
Right.
So then what we have is a company that starts, rises from the ashes of the Tri-State Wrestling Association, which was already blood, guts, and gore and some big names, goes through Eddie Gilbert, who brings in some hardcore Memphis influence and some hardcore Japanese influence, keeps in the stream of big names. You know, he's obviously, he knows everybody. So he's able to bring in like the Abdullah the Butchers and Stan Hansons and Road Warrior Hawks. And this is a time where I remember reading through the Pro Wrestling Illustrated magazines and seeing in the top 10 rankings, you know, I'm like, what is Jimmy Snuka doing in this ECW league? What is Road Warrior Hawk doing? And it's funny because Road Warrior Hawk had just wrestled in my high school gym in Fort Dodge in April of 93. And now I'm reading about him and all these other people wrestling in Philadelphia. And I'm like, wow, this is kind of impressive.
Yeah.
I don't know. And then the big turn came when Dusty, as you said, Eddie Gilbert was crazy. And Todd Gordon got sick of putting up with it, and Paulie got the book.
It was the best thing that could have happened to Paul Heyman. I remember at the time, Heyman was trying to start the World Wrestling Network or something.
With Jim Crockett.
Jim's
no-compete had just expired.
And they had all the big names that you just mentioned. They had Road Warrior Hawk, and they had, fucking Tito Santana working their TV tapings that never aired.
Yep.
So the connections were there. And, you know, you just got to be in the right place at the right time. Eddie was completely insane by this point and not worth keeping around. So Heyman slips in, and there you go.
And by this time, you've got a permanent residence at the ECW Arena, Viking Hall, the bingo hall that they slowly transformed into the ECW Arena. And they're taping TV there, and they're slowly also starting to pick up different markets. It wasn't small. I mean, starting with Madison Square Garden Network certainly isn't small, and it had its reach. I don't know, as far as those early TV shows, as far as the early product, and some of the things that Paulie brought, like we talked about last night in the previous audio, depends on when you're listening, characters like Sabu and the Public Enemy and 911, and it's just yet another bunch of examples of Paul Heyman's mind going at a mile a minute.
It's just a testament to his booking acumen because, 911 could have just been some dude with the wrong booker.
Mm-hmm.
But with Heyman booking, he was, very important, you know?
Yep.
A pivotal guy in the early ECW foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was protected and portrayed as a badass. And, watching that TV, you certainly believed it.
Yeah.
And I would say they got about, I don't know, but I was watching those early TV shows on, as I've mentioned 100 times, America 1, Channel 2, or Channel 11, or whatever it was out of Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were two different stations that I got that were America 1. That's why I think about it. And so I just have to see when they were on. And, they didn't run their listings in the TV guide. So I had to get the local Columbia Tribune would run whatever Channel 2 would show. And then I finally saw one day, I saw wrestling on this channel too, and so I checked it out. And fortunately, they were 8 weeks behind because I started watching this stuff probably about June of 94, and they were probably up to about, May of 94 at the time on the TV. But, they would run a show in ECW Arena, and they'd show pretty much the whole thing on TV.
Yeah.
They might hold back the main event, but they were getting, 4 weeks of TV or 3 weeks of TV off those shows.
Yep.
And that was kind of what they were recording. They had some TV tapings in the early days, separate from that, with some squash matches, but not, that wasn't a big part of the TV that I recall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was, ECW Arena shows were generally every 3 weeks, and they're always taped. That's the big thing. It's once Paul Heyman got the book, ECW actually started getting more, I guess, articles in PWI and The Wrestler, and I keep going back to those because when you're 12 years old, that's really, and you aren't in college and you don't get cool satellite stations, and that's really your only outlet for pro wrestling news. ECW really started getting, you know, actual feature-length articles in these magazines. And so, yeah, then you start reading about the Public Enemy doing this or the Tasmaniac doing that, and all of this Tasmaniac guy doesn't talk or whatever. What was I going to ask you, Dusty? Dan, I was going to ask you, just going back to the ideas that Paul Heyman was bringing to the table right away, and I ask you because you just watched the Rise and Fall of ECW DVD, or part of it anyway, earlier today. Paul Heyman said something along the lines of, you know, the few years previous, take music, we had the hair bands like Poison and
yep.
Motley Crue and all this stuff. And he said, and here come Nirvana, and wham! And, you know, in his typical overstated Paul Heyman way.
Yeah, he's extremely entertaining on that DVD.
Yeah, he really is. Can I help continue drawing that parallel? I mean, what did it mean? You know, I remember, like I said, I was 12, 13, whatever. I loved Nirvana. I was starting to play guitar. I thought this shit was really cool, too. ECW was awesome. I guess, what was your perspective, and, you know, is that a fair comparison for Paul Heyman to make?
Oh, I think definitely so. I mean, it was because the wrestling, the Raven character came later, and that's, I think, where some of the Nirvana stuff comes in, the
mm-hmm.
Kurt Cobain and Raven comparison you could make or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing of it is that the mainstream wrestling, just like the hair bands, were pretty bad. And if, you know, I'm dating myself here showing my age, but, you know, I was in just getting ready to enter grad school, so I'm, you know, 21, 22, whatever at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm moving to Columbia where I can watch this stuff. And, you know, we're getting, I remember we got, this was the time Hulk Hogan went to WCW, and we got the Bash at the Beach. This was right before I would have left my undergrad friends in Springfield. And so there were things happening in wrestling, but so much of it was kiddie driven and not geared toward adults in any way. There was no blood. There was no interviews that were all that provocative or interesting. And, you know, WCW was transforming into this Hulk Hogan promotion, which wasn't what very many longtime WCW fans or NWA fans, which I was, wanted to see.
Mm-hmm.
And WWF was promoting a lot. It wasn't all bad, but there was certainly a fair amount of these cartoon characters there also. And so the fact that ECW embraced the fact that they were different and made fun of the other groups just repeatedly. And you talked about Joey Styles last night in our audio about how great he was at doing that. It really was a different thing, and way before the days that these type of shoot comments became passe, is doing it, you know, saying it too kindly what it is today.
Mm-hmm.
They just make these little, and I wasn't an inside fan, but they'd make these little remarks about the other groups. You'd be like, damn, I can't believe they said that. And it was so cool. I don't know. It was definitely for, 18 to 34, 18 to 30, 18 to 28, I don't know, male audience. And it was great.
And smarter crowds, like you said. I remember Joey Styles saying things like, this is why we don't tape at Disney World and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
Dusty, you're my age, and of course we were both weaned on WWF, and you know, around that time, my God, one year you had a Survivor Series team full of doinks, the next team you have a Survivor Series team full of midget doinks. And yeah, they did have, you know, and like Dan said, Hulk Hogan goes from WWF to WCW, WCW formerly being the place where you go to watch good wrestling, and now Hogan's, you know, he's contagious, basically, and everything's turning into a kiddie federation. I did want to go back, just because, Dan, you mentioned blood. It got me thinking back to the Philadelphia aspect of this conversation. When practically nobody was bleeding in the WWF, I remember SummerSlam 90 was held in Philadelphia, and Rick Rude tried to blade, and there's a little tiny trickle of blood coming down his face. And then that Halloween Havoc 92 pay-per-view that I mentioned last night where the baby faces were getting booed out of the arena. Dusty, I guess these were some formative early years. What did you? How? I guess kind of also continue that parallel between. And you're a Motley Crue fan too.
Yeah,
I was too. I'm not going to lie about that. Sorry.
No. Yeah, I absolutely hated Nirvana, and I loved Motley Crue, and it was really a sad time for me. Really depressing.
But as far as the impact ECW had on you as a young fan?
Oh, it was everything I was looking for.
Mm-hmm.
I was begging for this shit, you know? Because I started watching in the late 80s, and WCW was just offering reruns, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I felt like it was fucking Groundhog Day or something, you know? Like, I've seen Hogan versus Earthquake. I've seen Brutus the Barber, you know? Why are you fucking bringing that shit back, you know? And it's not what WCW was supposed to be about. They were supposed to be more of a wrestling-oriented alternative.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, they tried to match WWF by doing the same things they were doing. I never understood that. And it was just a really depressing time to be a wrestling fan. Everything seemed to be rock bottom. So ECW comes along, offering a more realistic style and good storylines, and I was like, yeah, this is what I wanted.
And plus, I remember part of the impact for me when I got my first videotape, it was just in this dark, dank little building, you know, and I kind of had that intimacy where it's like, wow, I feel like I'm a part of something very special that no one knows about.
Yep.
No, that's a very good point.
Yep. And plus, it was full of people that were just as pissed off as the rest of us were. I mean, Paul E., you know, leading the charge of angsty, angry people in pro wrestling. And then you get, like I said last night, this cast of characters that includes Shane Douglas, who we can actually, if we want to, fast forward to 1994. ECW, when it was Eastern Championship Wrestling, under the umbrella of the NWA, and it was becoming this, like, darling wrestling federation that people were starting to hear about, and it was starting to make waves. The NWA wanted to try to, you know, re-kickstart their career, their relevance in professional wrestling, and hold a world title tournament, and they wanted it hosted in Philadelphia with ECW. All the different promoters got together, decided that Shane Douglas was going to be the champion. I guess the story goes Shane Douglas had been done wrong by Dennis Coraluzzo in the past. Not to mention he just, you know, pretty much hated everything the NWA stood for at that point. Paul Heyman talked him into throwing the belt down. And Dan, I know that you talked about it last night. If you can kind of summarize again for us the turn of events that happened there.
Yeah, well, what they did was they built up to this NWA title tournament in August of 1994, and Shane Douglas had been Eastern champion for some time, and I want to say that this was around the time that they brought Ron Simmons in to wrestle him. Never got over as much as you might expect, but I mean, I thought they had some good matches. At some point in here, he wrestled Tully Blanchard a few times, and they were definitely trying to build him up as a wrestling champion even before he won the NWA title, and certainly after this. They brought in Brian Pillman. They were supposed to bring Steve Austin in to team with him at one of the cards. I want to say November to Remember 94, but I could be wrong about that. And Austin got hurt, and they brought in Brian Pillman instead. So, you know, Shane Douglas is certainly – there was never a one feature of the – promotion. It was always looking at a number of different, a number of different wrestlers as being part of the promotion. I'm looking at this, and Douglas was wrestling Ron Simmons at November to Remember 94, so it was a little bit after this August time. But Shane Douglas was the centerpiece wrestler, and it had the great match with Sabu and Terry Funk we talked about last night, and so. They built up this NWA tournament as a huge deal and was going to be a great card with, you know, they brought in Dean Malenko for it, I recall, and what a great wrestler he was. And they had a Japanese wrestler in the tournament. And, you know, 9-1-1, and then the mystery guy that was Doink the Clown, which gave 9-1-1 a way of destroying Doink the Clown and making the ECW fans go nuts. Mm-hmm. And then as I mentioned last night, he had a great match with Too Cold Scorpio in the tournament finals. And, you know, they had built this into an old-style NWA wrestling match. And you thought, well, this is an alternative to WCW. They're getting away from wrestling. This is going to be the wrestling league, whatever. And then he does this fantastic promo where he does throw down the belt and declared himself the first ECW World Heavyweight Champion. The mm-hmm. best part of the entire angle was the fact they got Dennis Carluzzo to bitch and moan about this on ECW TV about how this is a disgrace, the NWA was going to do something about it, and basically had him endorsing that ECW had really broken away and done something special. It wasn't his best shining moment to be on record speaking out against that. And then,
well, it kind of shows what a mark he was for himself, and I suppose he thought he was being a mark for the business too. It's like, if you're really that angry, maybe you should shut up when the camera's on you. Maybe you should, like, get over yourself long enough to realize that your opposition. You're
playing into the angle. I mean, he definitely did, and I think he said he got fooled, and I think he probably did. There's no business reason to endorse a company that just screwed you over in front of their entire audience. I mean, they didn't work with the NWA after that.
Yeah. Let's see. Off the NWA title topic, but I don't know. For some reason, this kind of struck me as something worth talking about, too, in 94. And Dusty, I'll throw this at you because I know how big of a Cactus Jack fan you are. And I'm sorry I keep lobbing the Cactus Jack stuff at you, but this is also the year.
Yeah,
this is the
like
year.
When people interviewing Cornette keep bringing up Vince Russo.
Yeah, I know. But this was one of those I don't know, line-crossing, boundary-crossing things when Cactus Jack, like I mentioned last night, wrestled Sabu at Hostile City Showdown 94, and he cut the promo after the show, and he spit on the WCW belt, threw it down, put over ECW as this pretty much superior product, as Sabu as the superior wrestler to Cactus Jack even, and then a couple months later, WCW had the gall to run a hotline poll: should WCW fire Cactus Jack? But they never explained why.
Right.
And then he ends up leaving after a loser leaves town match to Kevin Sullivan and walking out through the crowd. We're going to see if you had any thoughts on that in particular, just any other talent that was being brought in at the time.
Yeah, well, just to do some cleanup, the Tully Blanchard match was January 95, the hour draw. I guess it was only like 50 minutes in real time because everybody was like shit.
Yeah, it wasn't going over well. Yeah.
They had to stop it. I think the fans turned their back on the match.
I
remember right. How's that for a phenomenon? If you present them a shitty match, they will turn their back on the action. I think that's fascinating.
Yep.
The other thing I was going to say is, reading about Douglas throwing the belt down inspired me to seek out ECW videotapes.
Mm.
That was like the whoa, you know, kind of thing, where it really clicked in my head that ECW was something special.
Cool.
So, and I wanted to see them do Matt Bourne, you know, how they handled that character. That
the
was
Born Again.
Yeah, Born Again.
Yep.
That was really interesting.
Yeah, he was doing the half, just for people that don't know, he was doing the half Doink the Clown face paint and half not there for a while, and then I think he had some out-of-the-ring issues that cut short his stay in ECW.
Yeah, he only lasted maybe a few months, but it was great. He was cutting like Roddy Piper-style promos. Very
good thing
shit.
The thing that I read that was actually the reason he left the company was that he asked to do a show by Dennis Corluzzo, and Paul was like, nope, you're fired.
Yeah, that was
his story, or was that the ECW story?
I don't know. That's not to say that he wasn't doing copious amounts of drugs, though, too.
Which, as Dusty mentioned last night, it might have been tough to get fired from ECW for that, but that was some of the story as to why he wasn't kept along.
Yep.
Yeah, his shoot interview is basically, well, I did a bunch of drugs in Portland. Well, I did a bunch of drugs in New York, you know.
Nice.
If Are we trying to go year by year here? Is there other? There was one other thing I wanted to mention that I think was 1994, but I don't want to manipulate things too much.
What do you got?
Well, as I recall, were you guys watching the TV at that time, or were you able to get it anyway, or just getting the magazines and the videotapes? I'm assuming you're saying it's mostly the videotapes. You know, again, I'm watching the weekly TV, and we talked about Stevie Richards last night, and I believe it was toward the end of 94. I hope my timing's not too badly off on this, where Stevie Richards every week would start dressing up as Johnny Polo, Scotty the Body, Scotty Flamingo. And it was this ongoing thing that you were like, you know, and Stevie Richards had been kind of the, you know, the coolest putz, the whole thing for this whole time. And I guess it should have been obvious where they were going with it, but I remember when Raven showed up, I was like, oh, this makes sense. And it was really a good way to introduce Raven. And again, to Stevie Richards' credit, he helped build that anticipation to that character, which would be a big part of 1995 and beyond. And I believe that started in toward the end of 94 when Stevie started doing the impressions on TV.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, late 94.
Raven made his ECW Arena debut in January 95. And Dusty, I know you're a big Raven fan, and I know I'm assuming then you're a big Scott Levy fan overall. Talk about just like what a departure the Raven character was from everything else that he played.
Now, I remember reading the first-hand report in the Tribune, and they described it as like almost a WWF-style character because it was like just so different from everything ECW had done. But once you get to look at it, it's very ECW. It's it basically defined ECW. And he had gone from carrying the polo mallet and wearing the Hawaiian shirts to looking like what he was looking like as Raven.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't even look like the same guy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It was
in a way, like I said last night, I think that it was sort of a reflection of Paul Heyman if he thought he were a wrestler. But in a way, just like you said, he was ECW. It was almost like holding a mirror up to the ECW arena, just average fan. The guy in the black T-shirt and the leather jacket and the jeans and the fucked up hair and the bad attitude and hated life.
Who thinks that people don't understand him. Yep. I'm sure almost every ECW fan felt like misunderstood in some way, you know?
Yep. And I actually did a Lounge column about this for the Torch. I don't remember when exactly, but the idea that the ECW arena crowd was what's the word I'm looking for? Well, anyway, they were set up to boo Raven. They're set up to dislike Raven, who was
basically
them. Hey,
hold on a second.
Okay.
In that column, were you jumping to conclusions at all?
Probably, yeah. I probably was.
As long as you offered some constructive criticism, it's okay.
Very nice.
Okay, anyway, go ahead.
So they were set up to hate Raven, who was basically them in a wrestling ring. And they were set up to love Tommy Dreamer, who was this high school jock, this guy that probably beat all of them up in high school. And it's like, it's either like mind-blowingly ironic or just completely brilliant of Paul Heyman to set this up the way he did.
It's Paul Heyman's mind control that he made it happen.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And yeah, we can talk about that feud too, because I mean, that carried, I mean, we're getting into 1995 now. The Tommy Dreamer Raven feud really carried the next 2 years, or at least it carried through for the next 2 years anyway. And we talked last night about Tommy Dreamer. Dan, you were watching the TV at the time. Talk about the evolution of Tommy Dreamer a little bit again since we talked about it last night.
Yeah, I mean, we gave that a pretty good talk last night, and we encourage people to listen to part one. But that whole, you know, pretty boy, suspenders-wearing guy that, you know, wasn't going to get over anywhere except maybe WCW at the time, and I'm not even sure about that. Or maybe, I shouldn't say get over, but maybe get pushed in WCW at the time. And then, of course, had the entire feud with the Sandman where he started his transformation, took the 10 lashes with the Singapore cane where he got his back busted open legitimately. And, you know, that whole, you know, we're still in 94, 95, that whole retirement ceremony for the Sandman at November Remember 94. Wow, you know, really got things going. And then he was kind of feuding with Sandman at the time that Raven was introduced, and then it certainly didn't take long for him to segue into feuding with Raven. And, you know, that's when he became the black T-shirt wearing common man type character in ECW that certainly did become accepted. And probably, and again, part of this is having watched the rise and fall of ECW today, but I think that it's true that the match where he, you know, they had the thing at the end and he pile drove Beulah and did the pose in front of the arena and the place is just going bonkers. That kind of cemented him as a hero to the ECW arena fans. And that would have been, I guess, middle 95, if I'm not mistaken, also.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, and it's more of that woman-hating, you know, whatever, black T-shirt wearing crowd stuff that ECW ate up. Dusty, talk about kind of the dog and pony show aspect of the Tommy Dreamer Raven feud. We talked about that a little bit last night too, but this was, I don't know if this was this a Paul Heyman staple?
It was definitely a Raven staple. He carried it with him the entire time he was there. The first people he used were Tony Stetson and Johnny Hotbody, the former ECW World Tag Team Champions.
Unbelievable.
And, yeah, just had them bump around and job to Dreamer on his way to Raven. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
It's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
Because it adds a different dimension to it, and it protects Raven. I mean, and he looks like a chicken shit in the process.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's got all these guys with him.
And it's a way to slowly burn through a feud.
Yeah, definitely. And especially like what he did, he kept rotating goons. He had the Dudleys for a while, and then the Bruce Brothers, and Brian Lee.
Yep.
Just all kinds of different people to busy Dreamer with.
Yep, and Blue Meanie, and then...
Meanie, Nova, Richard, yep.
Yep. Yeah, and Stevie Richards' angle where he had to try to find the skankiest woman he could find for Raven.
He said Blue Dust was too feminine for him.
That's awesome.
Love it.
What was the name of that hooker?
I was trying to think of it.
Divine Brown.
Divine Brown.
Divine Brown.
Thank you. Yes, they even brought in Hugh Grant's hooker for one night only. Unbelievable to get this angle over. The lengths that Paul Heyman would go to do some of this shit was just incredible and brilliant.
Yeah. As far as bringing in celebrities, I have to say Divine Brown was a better get than the guy who got his penis chopped off. Bobbitt?
Yeah. John
Wayne Bobbitt, yeah. What the fuck? Anyway.
If it wasn't for some shrinkage, ladies, am I right?
Let's not busy ourselves with old names.
Let's not bring up past names. Fucking creep. Hey, aren't you? Copyright infringement, ladies.
Nothing to see here.
That's fucking great. Let's see. What else did 1995 bring with it? I know guys like Benoit had made their... Chris Benoit,
yeah.
Excuse me, I'll say his full name even though he's dead and we're not allowed to say his name ever anywhere else.
It's too soon.
I know he'd been there a couple months earlier, but I remember I got the double tables match from February of 1995. I talked about that last night and it was Sabu and Taz versus the Public Enemy in a tables match.
Oh my God.
And Chris Benoit versus Al Snow. And by this point, I think Benoit had already been dubbed the Crippler, the Canadian Crippler, right?
Yeah, he was the Crippler and the Shooter, pretty much that was their nickname from day one, I think.
Yep. I always just, whenever I think of 1995, I think of it as kind of the work rate era of ECW. And Dan, I don't know if is that something you would agree with. We've got Malenko, Guerrero, the Luchadors with Conan come in.
Yeah. No, there was that pretty seamless transition from the American workers to the Luchas in late 95. And if we're kind of talking about this, this is, you know, where I was just eating this stuff up. They had the three-way dance, the three-way match for the tag titles, I think, in February of 95, if I'm not mistaken, mm-hmm. where – or no, that wasn't a three. I'm sorry. They just beat – they beat Sabu and Taz for the titles, Benoit and Malenko did, mm-hmm. in February 95 to set up the three-way match. That's what it was because Public Enemy had been hurt in late 94. Rocco Rock had been hurt. And so then they had Benoit and Malenko go over Sabu and Taz, who had beaten Rock and Grunge for the titles like 3 weeks mm-hmm. earlier than that, at Double Tables.
Yep.
And so that Benoit was very much involved in that show with the Al Snow match you mentioned. Then they won the titles 3 weeks later. They set up a thing I couldn't wait for from watching the TV, which was the three-way dance in April of 95. And that's the F. Sabu show where Paulie went out and took the mic and talked about how Sabu thought he was too good for the ECW arena, and they brought in Rick Steiner to team with Taz instead, and Sabu was gone from the company until November to Remember of that year. But, you know, that was something unique also that they kind of air their dirty laundry in front of the crowd and then obviously offer anybody a refund if they were wanting to leave, and Paul was smart that way. Nobody was going to leave. I mean, they were like, well, how, it's not ECW's fault. We're loyal to this company. And Rick Steiner was certainly a reasonable substitute for Sabu in that three-way match, which would have been April of 95.
Yep.
He was still a very good worker at that point. That's before he stopped trying.
Yep.
Yeah, before his inflated contracts from his buddy Eric Bischoff.
And the Steiners, you know, I don't think they ever
lost. A year.
Sorry, Dustin.
$1.2 million a year. For Rick Steiner. Jeez. Come on.
Unbelievable.
But, you know, the Steiners, I don't think they ever lost, but they worked when the Eliminators came into ECW at first, and they, you know, some of the stuff that aired on TV was good. I mean, they I think that they were working harder for Paul than they did for some other folks later in their careers.
Yeah.
I remember in 94, I think it was, the Eliminators got a tryout in WWF and they shit on them. The clique just hazed the shit out of them. And
that's not
surprising. That probably kind of triggered the attitude there, you know? Like, Saturn was always very good, you know, and he didn't deserve to get shit on.
Yeah.
I imagine it was probably because they were tiny. I mean, Saturn's a pretty small guy, actually, so here's... You know, big Kevin Nash and these medium-sized Scott Hall. And of course, they had X-Pac running around with him, but, you know, it's neither here nor there. He was just there to carry bags and throw up on himself.
yes!
Yeah, so then you get some, like, muscle-bound, tiny guy like Saturn. And, yeah, I can see where they would make fun of him, but there's no base for it whatsoever.
Right.
But the one guy we didn't mention last night that was a big part of 95 was Shane Douglas introducing referee Bill Alfonso to the Knicks and ECW. And I happened to watch today my ECW tape, which is great because it has, or the DVD that I bought, the Hardcore History, that has the Pit Bulls versus Raven and Richards for the tag team titles, which, again, if you watch that match not knowing the lead up and the storyline, it might not hold up as well. But when you know how they were waiting for 9-1-1 to chokeslam Bill Alfonso, they were waiting for Tommy Dreamer to pin Raven, people were waiting for the Pit Bulls to get the titles, that would have been August of 95, and that match is just off the charts good in terms of the overall booking you know, how excited you were to see the conclusion of that match, which is Bill Alfonso getting chokeslammed and the Pit Bulls winning the title. And so if we were talking about 95, I wanted to fit that in somewhere because that was a – Bill Alfonso was a big part of the show as the troubleshooting referee.
Mm-hmm. That plays more. That plays into more of that work to shoot aspect of ECW. You know, they couldn't work the smart fans every single ECW arena show, but they could play off of those things like we talked about, the Kane Dewey sign in the crowd, and then that turns into a big angle with Cactus Jack. Or, you know, the fact that Paul Heyman obviously has the 1,200 hardcore fans coming to the show every 3 weeks, so why not have a character who's completely anti-hardcore, this this referee who's going to lay down the law. Yeah, I was just, I'm going to keep using the word brilliant. I need to find a thesaurus here quick. let's see. But I mentioned the workers like the Benoits, Guerreros, Malenkos, and I do remember Guerrero and Malenko when they had their last match and they got the huge send-off and the crowd was chanting, please don't go, and whatnot. But that's not to discount the other style of wrestling that was pervasive in ECW at that time, which would have been the hardcore blood and gut style wrestling. Like, Dusty, you mentioned the Taipei death match last night.
I was saying they put it on fourth and had like three matches after it. How do you follow a Taipei death match, you know? Yeah. What could possibly match that? But, you know, whatever. You know, that's just me being an axle mark, I guess. But, I think it's important to note that they weren't just blood and guts. They'd have blood and guts, and then they'd have wrestling. And they'd have, you know, some basic mat work, and they'd have some high-flying stuff. So I think that gets lost in the translation for people who bash ECW, including Cornette.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, well, I mean, the 18 to 35-year-old male actually covers a lot of ground, and the fact that Paul was able to give a lot of people what they wanted, I mean, it can't be for everyone. In fact, they had a T-shirt at the time, ECW, it's not for everyone.
Yep.
But they had something for every style of wrestling fan, I think, within that demographic range.
Yep.
Which I think is really cool and spoke to Paul Heyman's genius at, I think, at age, by 95, he would have been like 29 or something like that.
Yeah.
God, I think I'm 29 right now. Kind of depressing in a way.
Sure.
95 was also the beginning of the Monday Night Wars. WCW got 2 hours of primetime TV on TNN or TNT, Turner Network. And yeah, so he put on Monday Nitro to compete with WWF's Monday Night Raw. And in doing so, he needed more talent. Surprisingly, he didn't want to fill up his 2 hour show on TNT with Hulk Hogan and his cronies. Yeah. So give Bischoff a tiny bit of credit for being forward thinking enough to go be on the lookout for talent and effectively stealing guys from ECW like Chris Benoit, Dean Malenko, Eddie Guerrero. Even had Sabu in there for a cup of coffee. Let's see. Dan, I'm assuming you're still watching the TV at this point. I guess, what did this do to the product of ECW at that time?
Yeah, well, that's where you brought up. I mean, at this point, I would argue 95, and you know, they were so good for so long, but probably would have been the best year for them to be on national TV and to be on pay-per-view. It's not that it got that much worse. I mean, it was excellent for years and years after that, but this was probably their creative peak where every week you were watching that TV show going, wow, I can't believe they did that now, and I can't believe – And when those guys left, they immediately brought in Rey Mysterio, Juventud Guerrera, Psychosis. They brought in Rey and Psychosis at first, and Conan. And you know, they didn't portray Conan as all that, to be honest, compared to the other guys. Right. But so you just felt like they can keep – well, yeah, it made some sense. That they can just keep finding these great wrestlers even when they lose guys. So as great as those guys were – again, I mentioned last night, the thing that broke my heart is when they lost the Public Enemy, because they were more entwined to the core of ECW, and to have those guys go to WCW and not be the same act, I mean, kind of the same act, but it was just the ridiculous uncensored WCW. Boy, they had some fun making fun of those WCW uncensoreds, I'll say that.
Oh my God!
On some of those interview segments they would run and things like that were just fantastic. But you know, as bad as much as you hated to see them leave, you thought, well, okay, they're getting paid, and ECW just seems to be able to keep finding guys. So at the time, it didn't bother me as much as it might have some people. I don't know.
Yeah, Dusty, who else was being replaced, and who else were they replenishing with?
Losing Public Enemy was the first piece of the heart of ECW that they really lost. Because a guy like Benoit or Malenko, that might have hurt, but it wasn't as pivotal to ECW as Public Enemy. Public Enemy was one of those acts where you never would have thought the big two would be even interested. But, yeah, like Dan said, God bless them. They made a lot of money, and they were logged into their perpetual feud with the Nasty Boys. But
more mustard was spilled during those matches than any other.
No. But, yeah, I mean, this was Paul Heyman's peak because the talent didn't run out in 2000, 2001. He just stopped going after it, you know?
Yeah.
But in 95, 96, he was still like, I lost Benoit. I'll bring in Mysterio, you know? Like, it didn't even faze him. He saw it as, like, a challenge, you know?
Yeah, and for every Mysterio he lost, he could bring in a Chris Jericho.
Yeah.
And for every Chris Jericho he lost, he could bring in a Lance Storm.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's a lot easier to replace, guys that you don't consider, like we said, the heart and soul of a piece of the actual jigsaw puzzle of ECW. Sometimes it was like the Benoits and Guerreros were the icing on the cake, you know. Of course, they can bring in a good 30-minute matches. But
you can always get new icing.
Yeah.
It's harder to make a new cake.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Once the cake part is already made.
And
exactly.
Just a message to some people that are, it's fortunate they can figure out how to type with some of the arguments they make against Paul Heyman being able to successfully book TNA today. The fact that someone had wrestling that I would argue on TNN that was still better than what else was being offered, at least by WCW at the time, that wasn't as creative as it was 5 years before that, when you are booking, trying to sign contracts, trying to get loans to keep your company afloat, trying to get on a different TV network, trying to do 85 different things as basically the owner of the company, the fact that that wasn't as creative of a period as the 95, 96, 97 era was, doesn't mean that you can't book today, 10 years later, if your only job is to book TNA and you don't have to pay bills, and you don't have to fly people in, and you don't have to do any of the other stuff that I think probably took a lot of his time at that point. It boggles the mind to read some of these arguments against Paul Heyman with the book that, I don't think he'll do any better. Why is that? Well, because I said so. That's not a legitimate argument, and if I'm sure whoever wrote that won't seek this out because they seem to only want to seek things that that build up their point of view. But God, I think Dusty's right. I mean, there was some talent out there, but it's understandable the guy couldn't book at the top of his game when he was trying to keep a company from going bankrupt and trying to find a buyer and do 20 million different other things.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, just take a look at a picture of late 2000 Paul Heyman.
Oh, God.
He's out of shape. Mm-hmm. He looks like he hasn't bathed in 3 years.
Slept or showered.
He's like just done. He's done, you know? And you can understand then that a person like that is just burnt the fuck out and it's time to move on.
Yeah.